The Well of Loneliness, written by Radcliffe Hall and read by L. Potter.
Book 1, Chapter 1. Not very far from Upton-on-Severn, between it, in fact, and the Malvern Hills, stands the country seat of the Gordons of Bramley, well-timbered, well-cottaged, well-fenced, and well-watered, having, in this latter respect, a stream that forks in exactly the right position to feed two large lakes in the grounds. The house itself is of Georgian red brick, with charming circular windows near the roof. It has dignity and pride without ostentation, self-assurance without arrogance, repose without inertia, and a gentle aloofness that, to those who know its spirit, but adds to its value as a home. It is indeed like certain lovely women who, now old, belong to a bygone generation, women who in youth were passionate but seemly, difficult to win, but when won, all-fulfilling. They are passing away, but their homesteads remain, and such an homestead is Morton. To Morton Hall came the Lady Anna Gordon as a bride of just over 20. She was lovely as only an Irish woman can be, having that in her bearing that betokened quiet pride, having that in her eyes that betokened great longing, having that in her body that betokened happy promise, the archetype of the very perfect woman whom creating God has found good. Sir Philip had met her away in County Clare, Anna Molloy, the slim virgin thing, all chastity, and his weariness had flown to her bosom as a spent bird will fly to its nest, as indeed such a bird had once flown to her, she told him, taking refuge from the perils of a storm. Sir Philip was a tall man and exceedingly well favoured, but his charm lay less in feature than in a certain wide expression, a tolerant expression that might almost be called noble, and in something sad yet gallant in his deep-set hazel eyes. His chin, which was firm, was very slightly cleft, his forehead intellectual, his hair tinged with auburn. His wide nostrilled nose was indicative of temper, but his lips were well modelled and sensitive and ardent. They revealed him as a dreamer and a lover. 29, when they had married, he had sown no few wild oats, yet Anna's true instinct made her trust him completely. Her guardian had disliked him, opposing the engagement, but in the end she had had her own way. And, as things turned out, her choice had been happy, for seldom had two people loved more than they did. They loved with an ardour undiminished by time. As they ripened, so their love ripened with them. Sir Philip never knew how much he longed for a son until, some 10 years after marriage, his wife conceived a child. Then he knew that this thing meant complete fulfilment, the fulfilment for which they had both been waiting. When she told him, he could not find words for expression and must just turn and weep on her shoulder. It never seemed to cross his mind for a moment that Anna might very well give him a daughter. He saw her only as a mother of sons, nor could her warnings disturb him. He christened the unborn infant Stephen, because he admired the pluck of that saint. He was not a religious man by instinct, being perhaps too much of a student, but he read the Bible for its fine literature, and Stephen had gripped his imagination. Thus he often discussed the future of their child. I think I shall put Stephen down for Harrow, or I'd rather like Stephen to finish off abroad. It widens one's outlook on life.